This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with civil rights attorney Carol Sobel about the recent $13 million verdict for victims of police abuse during the 2007 May Day demonstrations in Los Angeles. Videos showed police using batons and firing less than lethal rounds at the marchers.
We'll talk with author Nora Eisenberg, author of the recent book, When You Come Home.
This compelling novel, a page-turner, is about the so-called Good War, the first Iraq war, which, as this novel will have you finally believe, was not good at all.
Stay with us.
Michael Ratner, I hear there's big news in the baby department.
Well, you know, we never like to put the mantle or the burden of being an incredible progressive on any child because we should allow them to develop themselves. But there was a new baby born to Sarah Kunstler, who is the daughter of Margie Ratner Kunstler and William Kunstler, the noted famous trial attorney. And the boy's name, who was just born last week, is William Ferguson Kunstler.
That's because Jesse Ferguson is Sarah's companion.
So the new Bill Kunstler, or I think he's going to be called Will Kunstler, welcome to the world of radical politics, radical lawyers, and radical parents.
And keep up the tradition.
Continuing on that thought.
That's the next generation, Michael.
I hear that you just came back from debating some of the conservatives at Princeton. How did it go?
Well, I was at Princeton, which is whenever I have talks with any of my friends who've gone to Princeton, they always say they were one of the like three or four progressive people out of 10,000 or something.
Well, Einstein was at Princeton. Einstein made a lot of money in physics.
Right. The Institute for Advanced Studies is at Princeton. It's true. And I had a distant relative from my father's hometown of Bialystok, who ran the Institute for a while, or a distant friend of my family's. So I was at Princeton, and we had a debate on prosecution, which, as usual, I realize now that I'm so far out of the academic discussion of this that I'm looked at like a chimpanzee or something in a zoo, you know, that I'm considered to be like exotic because I actually say that these guys should be prosecuted. And everybody else, I mean, we have Scott Horton there. We had this guy named István Dík, who's actually interesting. He's 80 years old. He was a professor at Columbia, and he came out of Hungary. And he gave a nice story about how many people were actually prosecuted during the Second World War. So it was really thousands by the time they got through each of these states of Nazis and denazification and all that. So after he spoke, I was the second speaker. So I got up and I said, you know, I'm a lawyer, and we lawyers always cite precedent. So I'm really not going to have to speak very much. I'm just going to say István Dík has basically set the precedent. You prosecute war criminals. You prosecute heads of state. Go after them, and I rest my case, which, of course, got a big laugh, and then I could have sat down.
Should have.
Anyway. And then Charles Freed was the other guy. He was the conservative. He was the Solicitor General under George Bush I from 85 to 89. Quite conservative, Harvard professor, in his 70s probably, when he, of course, took a position totally contrary to prosecution, was scathing, really, about my surety, is what he called it, that I have 257 ways in which I'm sure of what should be done here. And I meant to say, when I was thinking about it coming up here, he said he's still pondering what to do in all this, but he's against prosecutions. But he does think that the memos were off the wall. I didn't have a chance to answer him, but what I was thinking of, the answer should have been the slogan of Marx, or the aphorism of Marx that's at the university in Berlin that Michael Smith and I talk about a lot. And what it says in German, I don't know, but the translation in English is, philosophers talk about the world, our job is to change it. When he talks to me about surety versus his pondering, pondering is what Princeton is about, or at least this part of the section of the people who were there with us was about. Certainly Charles Freed is about pondering, letting the world go on, continuing its torture.
Heretofore, philosophers have only talked about the world. The point is to change it.
Right.
What do you think?
I don't understand what the argument against prosecutions is.
Well, it's the usual. They're the old saws. The ones you hear normally, but I'll tell you what the real argument is. The ones we hear normally are, this criminalizes a policy difference. But of course, torture was against the law before they started torturing people.
Internationally and nationally.
Right. The second one is they were acting in the best interests of the United States. Well, of course, that's every torturer in the world, and that's what I said yesterday. Pinochet said he was acting in the best interests of Chile when he tortured and killed people. That's common. If you allowed people to basically break fundamental human rights law or law because they believe in best interests, you essentially have a lawless world. So I robbed a bank, but I thought it was in the best interest of my family that I had to rob the bank. Great going. So that's out. And then there's the legal memos is always the one, but that's complete BS. They were done to facilitate torture. What really goes down to when I read the quote, there's a guy, and I don't know if I sent it to you guys, Charles Simic is a Yugoslav born but American well-known famous poet. And he wrote a recent story in New York Review of Books, and he talked about how every country wants to make sure or really ensure its people that it is not committing war crimes. He starts from that premise. Then he says, but of course, there's special exceptions. The United States and Western powers believe that they never commit war crimes and that it just would be unthinkable for them to commit war crimes. And the role of ideologues and intellectuals in those countries is to tell the people and the population that their countries don't commit war crimes. So when you hear all these excuses from the Charles Frieds of the world, what it's really about is ideologues saying to the population of the United States, us, we're above it all. We don't commit war crimes. That's really what's going on here. There's no question. So it'll be on the Princeton website, I'm sure, at some point. But he really, he went after me in a way that was ad hominem attacks, essentially. Never answering me, going into some BS about violations of the warrantless wiretapping, the prohibition on warrantless wiretapping, which I never even talked about, which he was wrong about. But you realize they don't have a lot to say, really, against prosecutions, Heidi. They don't. I mean, there's
they only have one thing we don't have, state power.
This is true. And the question is, right now it's very contentious out there. It's better than I thought in terms of people wanting this. 61% of the country, according to polls, wants some sort of investigation or prosecution. 38% out of 100% want prosecutions. So we're talking about an environment in which even liberals are way behind what I think many in this country feel about the torture program.
Yeah, but what I admire about what you've done, Michael, is that it was an uphill fight and you never stopped fighting it and we're making progress. And that's what we have to do. You know, the civil rights movement was an uphill fight, and eventually we won some things. And this, too. You have to be optimistic, at least in your heart, even if pessimistic in your brain.
And we should say hello to the listeners from Princeton or Trenton. Many of them were at the lecture at Princeton. We appreciate their listening and their friendly compliments to our Law and Disorder show. They apparently love it. So thank you, people from New Jersey.
Following up on a story we've covered briefly before, the Justice Department has just launched an investigation, finally, into Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Listeners will remember he's been conducting immigration sweeps and apparently has a lot of wide local support for them. He goes into workplaces, picks up people on the street based on the color of their skin. According to four Democratic members of the House Judiciary Committee who have asked for this investigation, engages in alleged patterns and discriminatory practices and unconstitutional searches and seizures. It's racial profiling, essentially.
And then I think this guy's probably running for governor, because then he holds press conferences. He parades these people in black and white prison uniforms through to downtown. He makes them wear pink underwear. He houses them in tents. The guy's just an outright racist showboat.
And a racist showboat with wide support locally. He was just reelected to a fifth term this past November. So I think you're right, Michael. But we're glad that the Justice Department is looking into this.
You know, I just came back from Arizona. The sheriff and Charles Barkley, the basketball star, were all over the news there because Barkley got busted for drunk driving and agreed to cooperate with the sheriff. So he did three highly publicized days in their tent prison. And he praised the sheriff and he said, well, I did the time because I had it coming to me. And I talked to all the guys here and told them they shouldn't drive drunk. The sheriff used it as a way to further his political career, him and Charles Barkley, the ex-Republican.
Now, there's a lot going on right now, obviously, with the change in administrations in a number of cases that are pending in courts. And over the next few weeks, we'll try and update our listeners on a lot of these cases. Arar, the Syrian, the man taken to Syria for torture, the Jeppesen case, which is the ACLU case on renditions, the case that the Center for Constitutional Rights has pending, Razul v. Rumsfeld, which is about torture of people at Guantanamo. But the Padilla case has recently been in the news. And as people remember, Jose Padilla was, and I hate to use the term that the government uses, but was the so-called dirty bomber U.S. citizen who, as he got off the plane in Chicago, was arrested and held as an enemy combatant eventually for a number of years. Finally, under the Bush administration, as the case reached the Supreme Court, they took it away from the Supreme Court and indicted him and tried him, and he's serving time now for aiding terrorism or something.
They dropped the dirty bomber charge. The whole thing was a hoax.
Right, all that was a hoax. They convicted him on something else. But he stood there as a person who had been detained and essentially tortured for 3 or 4 or 5 years. It was held under the sort of John Yoo memorandums of enemy combatant. So what happens a couple of years ago, the clinic at Yale, where I used to teach, the Lowenstein Clinic, brings a lawsuit on behalf of Jose Padilla. It's a civil lawsuit for damages. They bring it against Ashcroft and others in North Carolina, but they also bring a case against John Yoo in California, and it has to be in California because that's where Yoo is teaching and lives. So they brought it in California for damages, but only for $1 in damages, and for a declaratory judgment that what happened to Padilla was unconstitutional. His detention without trial, his lack to access of counsel, his lack of access to the courts, and, of course, the abuse, torture, but really Fifth and Eighth Amendment constitutional violations that prohibit abuse and violence against prisoners. So that case was brought, as I said, in California. Recently, of course, as he's going to have to do in many cases, or as the administration is going to have to do, the administration has to come in, and they're defending now John Yoo on these various charges from the Yale Clinic made by Padilla. Now, it's an interesting statutory issue, which we don't have to go into, but there is an obligation on the United States to defend basically former administration people who are acting, quote, within the scope of employment, and according to the regulations, if it's not contrary to the interest of the United States. So my view is the U.S., the Obama administration, should get out of these cases, even if they have to pay for the attorneys for these guys, get themselves out. And I say that for a couple of reasons, because what happens now in this Padilla case is interesting. If I were John Yoo, I wouldn't want the Obama administration representing me. Because here's what happened, and it's a little complicated, but you want your attorney to make every argument you can if you're John Yoo. And what happens to the Obama administration? It has to come in and it has to argue, if they're representing you, which they are, that the right to be free from torture, the right to have a court access, the right to have an attorney was not clearly established law contrary to the Constitution when John Yoo made those decisions. In other words, even though a court may now decide it's unconstitutional to do what happened to Jose Padilla, at the time that Yoo made those decisions, it was not clearly established law, and therefore John Yoo might have a defense. So you have the Obama administration coming into court and now having to say this was not clearly established law when John Yoo did these memos. So They did file a brief, and the administration filed a brief in which they actually didn't defend you on the torture issue. They basically are acknowledging that that might be contrary to clearly established law. So what is you sitting there out? Why isn't he getting his own attorney or something? But that's an aside, because the big part of this case and what was really argued and what the government thought they would win is, here's what happens. The government, Obama attorneys, administration attorneys, go into court and they argue that this case is nothing except a case about John Yoo giving legal advice to others. And John Yoo was not the one who said Jose Padilla should be held as an enemy combatant, who said he should be denied access to courts, who said he shouldn't have an attorney, and who said that he should be tortured. And therefore, legal advice should not get you into a court at the end of a damage action. And the judge was very, very skeptical of that. And that's a very important piece of skepticism. Now, it's also true that the complaint in this case does not just talk about giving legal advice. This was not about just giving legal advice. When you read the complaint, Padilla versus Yoo, you see what they say is that Yoo did a lot more than just give legal advice. He was part of what's called the War Council, and he is the one that helped essentially set the policy and the practice in particular for Jose Padilla. And in fact, in some of the memos that are released recently, they actually mention Jose Padilla's name. So what Yale and what the Lowenstein Clinic is arguing and what Padilla is arguing is that this was not just legal advice. This was advice that actually facilitated him being kept in isolation as well as his torture. And I think the judge is going to go with it. That would be my hope. You never know, but we think so.
Seen that way from the newspaper reports, but what's so disgusting is that it seems that the Obama administration is carrying water now for the past Bush administration with the arguments that it's making.
Michael, does that mean essentially that you as a co-conspirator in this?
Oh, yes. Really aiding and abetting or co-conspirator. The administration, the Obama administration, ought to get out of the business of representing these guys because it's certainly it puts them in a position. What are they going to do? Say that it wasn't clearly established law, that you couldn't torture people at the time that you wrote the memos? Of course it was clearly established law.
Well, don't you think they know that?
Well, of course they know that, and that's why they were a little tricky in their brief on that one issue. But John Yoo is sitting there, essentially, obviously to my great gratification, exposed on that issue. But from his point of view, he should have another attorney. On other issues, on the other hand, the Obama administration has taken a bad position. I mean, the idea that you could hold someone as an enemy combatant who is an American citizen, who was arrested in the United States, hold them in a brig, deny them counsel, and deny them the right to go to court, that seems to me that under our Constitution, it was clearly established law. You could not do that at the time Padilla was held and you wrote those memos. And now you have the Obama administration saying, you can. You can do that. Well, that just seems to me not just a contradiction. It seems to me to be a continuation of the Bush policies that you can hold American citizens arrested in the United States, captured is the better word, as enemy combatants. And I say that knowing now because the two cases we have Padilla, and I don't want to mix people up, but we've talked about El Mari, who is the other enemy combatant, not a citizen, but again in the United States. And recently the United States said, the Obama administration said, we're no longer going to hold Al-Mari as an enemy combatant, but they refrained from saying we give up the power to hold people in the United States as enemy combatants. So if you put these two cases together, Padilla and Al-Mari, you really get the sum is the same as the Bush policy, at least theoretically. That the administration is still says or claims, the Obama administration, that it may well have the right to classify American citizens even as enemy combatants who were picked up in the United States and hold them in a brig. Pretty shocking.
Yeah, and add that to the Mohammed case out in San Francisco, where he was rendered to Morocco and tortured, had his genitals sliced with a razor, and the United States wouldn't help him out, asserting the state secrets privilege. Add those three things together, that's a pretty dismal report card.
You're talking about the Jeppesen case, which was the ACLU case, in which there's a number of people who were rendered around the world, and they did come in, and that, of course, is exactly what you said, Michael. The bench or the judges asked the lawyer for the Obama administration, are you taking the same position to dismiss this case on state secrets as the Bush administration did? And the lawyer said yes, and they said, and the judge came back and said, are you sure? Have you really thoroughly examined this? Because they were so shocked by it.
What about the elections, the judge said?
Right. And well, what about the elections?
In a landmark class action lawsuit settlement, the Los Angeles City Council agreed to pay nearly $13 million to those injured or mistreated in the 2007 May Day demonstration in MacArthur Park. As the march ended, LAPD riot police were filmed by camera crews using excessive force, firing rubber bullets, and striking people wantonly with batons. Dozens were injured in the melee, and the footage was seen around the world. The $13 million settlement was part of a larger portion of nearly 300 May Day claims. Today we're joined by California civil rights attorney Carol Sobel, who's also a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild. She was one of many attorneys working on this landmark case. Welcome, Carol, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Carol Sobel, you were one of the wonderful National Lawyers Guild attorneys that handled the case against the Los Angeles Police Department for their brutalization of hundreds of people on May Day, May 1st, 2007. Tell us the story, please.
Okay. And first, let me say that there were approximately 20 lawyers on this case. It was a great team from the National Lawyers Guild, the Guild's National Police Accountability Project, and MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. This case arose out of events that occurred on May 1st, 2007 in this huge inner city park we have in Los Angeles called MacArthur Park. It's somewhat like, you know, Central Park, but not quite as centrally located in this city. There was an immigrants' rights march, as there almost always is on May 1st. There's some sort of event. There has been for 7 or 8 years. That year, 2007, the police didn't want to give the permit that the group wanted to close the streets and march in the streets. So the group didn't want to go where the police wanted them to go, which was downtown with a different group. They wanted to be in MacArthur Park, which is the heart of our Central American community in Los Angeles. So they started out on the sidewalks, and then there were too many of them, as we knew there would be. But they didn't want to give up their route, and we advised them, take the sidewalks, agree to the sidewalks. So the police closed the streets, but as they got to MacArthur Park with about anywhere from 6,000 to 10,000 people, the police forgot to direct people into the park. And our park has a major east-west boulevard, Wilshire Boulevard, for those who are familiar, running through the middle of the park. It's an 8-lane road. So basically, they were coming up from the south to the north, and the rally was in the northwest corner of the park, of the top half of the park. So you had to cross Wilshire or enter on Wilshire, and it created chaos. And I lay all this out because the chaos the police created was the cause of the problems that then arose. There was no instruction to people. People didn't know where they were supposed to go. All they knew is all of a sudden they were met by a line of cops on motorcycles who were using the motorcycles to hit the protesters. And people had no idea where they were supposed to go. So eventually, those initial two confrontations got worked out. The police used the motorcycles to strike people who were watching the Aztec Dancers, which is a group that participates in all our major marches and does a circle dance to close the march and begin the rally. And while they were doing that, the police struck people on Alvarado, and then another group of police officers struck people on Wilshire.
And what were they using? Batons?
Motorcycles. Right. They were just riding their motorcycles into people. Then they brought in a whole line of police on corner of Alvarado and 7th, I guess it was, to strike people with batons as well and push them back. So that all got sort of settled down. But what it did was it meant that people who had been at the rally in the northwest corner suddenly ran over to the northeast corner of the park, which is a huge, huge 2 blocks away, and lined up on the sidewalk and were facing off with this line of police who now had batons on, riot helmets, etc.
Now, were there orders to disperse at any point?
Much later. This particular standoff on Alvarado and the one on Wilshire went on for a little while, and during the course of it, a few people on Alvarado did throw some things at the police. They threw food wrappers, they threw empty water bottles. They threw a slushie because there's pictures of it on the officer's helmet. But that all settled down. And the radio transmissions from the police indicate that there was about, I'd say, 40 minutes that passed with nothing occurring, maybe 30 minutes. And all of a sudden you hear some officers saying, we need to get rid of these people. I don't care if they're not throwing anything now. And literally, you probably had 4 or 5 people throw something, and no officer was hurt. And it had all sort of resolved itself. And in fact, at one point they had pulled the officers out of the street. People started moving back to the other side. And then a new line of officers came in because now they knew they were going to give an order to, they were going to disperse the group. They never gave an order to disperse. Our Metro Division, which is our elite division with SWAT and the bomb squad and everybody else, Metro Division lined up a platoon at 7th and Alvarado, the southeast corner of the park, and started marching in. And all they said to people was, move. They didn't say, this is an unlawful assembly. There were a small group of kids with bandanas on. They didn't do anything to the cops, but the cops don't like people with bandanas. So the police were chasing them. The group was in the park. And maybe there were 15 people out of the 10,000 people in the park that day. Rather than isolate those people and arrest them as they should have done, they decided they were going to get everybody out of the park. So as I said, they started moving in. The officers were only speaking English. The crowd mostly spoke only Spanish. You know, you had families there. They had no idea why these officers were coming in with these, you know, with riot gear on. And this is Metro, so they had more riot gear on. and batons out. And as they were saying, move, people are looking at them and thinking, well, I didn't do anything wrong. They couldn't be talking to me, and I don't know what they're saying. So the officer started knocking people down and hitting people, and then people started running, and it was total chaos. When they got to the north part of the park, they had to, the officers had to cross Wilshire. As they went across Wilshire, they had a couple of vendors and other people who were just sitting on this little stone wall. The officer just gratuitously stepped out of the line and knocked them off. People got hit. People got knocked down, broken bones. You know, it was just a police riot.
$13 million. Is that to send a message to the cops?
There are 300 represented people in these cases, and that's really quite a fair amount. The department, to its credit, you know, we have a history of police chiefs in the city who say it was never our fault. And we started out that way with Chief Bratton on this event. The night of May 1st, he said there were 50 to 100 agitator anarchists. It became one word, an agitator anarchist. And they were at fault because they had provoked the police. And then people started saying, come on, you know, you've got a couple of hundred well-trained police here. You're telling us there were a handful of anarchists, which they're, you know, they're not anarchists in the sense that we all know what anarchists are, but they're just a bunch of kids. So as the days went on, by the second day, the police chief stepped back from that position, I think because the mayor and other people said, wait a minute, you know, those videos don't look like the police got provoked. And as the days went on, the chief dropped the number of agitator anarchists so that in their final report, and now he talks about 10 to 15 people that the police were watching. Quite frankly, the police did a report that took responsibility for what happened and said there was no probable cause, no reason to go after these people. I told you that all they said was move. They never gave a dispersal order and declared an unlawful assembly until a little bit more than 3 minutes after they started hitting people and shooting them.
Carol, I'm a bit surprised because a few years ago, wasn't there a settlement vis-a-vis the parade regulations for police that they weren't supposed to use this kind of force?
There was a settlement after the Democratic National Convention here in Los Angeles in 2000. We filed lawsuits as well, and a consolidated march in October 22nd coalition had a few months later. And at both of those events, the police used less lethal weapons and batons on people and declared unlawful assemblies. In the October 22nd, they did not declare an unlawful assembly. They simply didn't want to honor the permit that had been granted by the police commission. And they decided on the spot not to let people march where they had a permit to go.
So is there a consent decree in order?
There was a settlement agreement, and it had 5 or 6 points in it, including how you declare an unlawful assembly when you do, how you have to arrest people. If you have a few isolated people, you arrest them rather than shut down. It had limitations on when they could use less lethal weapons, shoot these projectiles at people. It had limitations on the helicopters, the horses, and the use of motorcycles to strike people. That agreement never was put into effect. But for that agreement was signed in 2005. By May of 2007, we had this problem. And what had occurred in between is the department had not done any training on the DNC settlement. They now say that. They never trained anyone on it. In addition, in that two-year period, Metropolitan Division, the elite group that responds to demonstrations, had decided that they were going to do their own training. And their training was not only contrary to what the DNC settlement was about in terms of the use of less lethals and the use of batons, et cetera, but it was contrary to longstanding department policy on the use of batons. But it was the official policy because this is the way they were training and no one stopped them. What we have now as part of the settlement, and it still has to be approved by the court, and there's some final approval from the city government as well that's necessary, is an order that the court is going to issue dealing with all of these elements on the unlawful assembly, the use of batons, the use of motorcycles, the use of less lethals. And the court is going to issue an order and retain jurisdiction for 4 years with a possible extension so that if there is a problem with how the LAPD responds to demonstrations, the court is going to step in.
Total victory. For those listeners who are just tuning in, we're speaking with attorney Carol Sobel from the National Lawyers Guild out in Los Angeles. Carol was one of the attorneys that was responsible for this marvelous civil liberties victory over the Los Angeles Police Department, a police department with a brutal history going all the way back to the 20s and 30s, I believe. Carol, what do you think the lessons of all this are?
Well, I think the lesson for the department, certainly, is that the lesson we all know, which is that it's very difficult to change the culture of a police department. We have put these changes on paper before, but translating that paper into action is always an issue. I think the lesson for the department is that they have to address these issues. They have to be prepared in these situations.
Carol Sobel, we understand that your colleague Jim Lafferty, you were the longtime president of the Lawyers Guild and out in L.A., and Jim's the executive director. And I know there's a backstory to this because Jim had a developing relationship with the number two guy at the LAPD. Tell us that story, will you?
We have a really active program here in Los Angeles. And as you mentioned, Jim has been, you know, very instrumental in the Legal Observers. I've been, when I was with the ACLU until 1997 for almost 15, 20 years, I really was the lawyer who did most of the protest litigation in this city, along with my colleagues at the ACLU. I didn't do it alone. Some other private guild members like Carol Watson, the past president of the Lawyers Guild out here, and her partner, Humanis. And together, you know, we all did most of the protest litigation in the city, and we would see the same officers. So, for example, there were officers who were lieutenants when I started doing this stuff back in the 1980s, and they are now deputy chiefs. And so there's that long history, and it really gives us, I think, the ability to work with the police in the field, to have the police, you know, that coupled with the litigation we've done over the years. We frankly never lost one of these cases, and that, I think, has really helped us to be able to discuss with the police in advance what it is that needs to be done so that people can protest safely in this city without fearing that they're going to be assaulted by the police.
Now, you've done an extraordinary job. I was out there a while ago when Bush was still president, and in New York, you couldn't get anywhere near Bush when he'd come to town. In Los Angeles, we were kind of across the street demonstrating against him.
Right. There was a demonstration in Century City, which Century City is sort of in the middle of the city, and it is historically been where the most police brutality occurred from Ronald Reagan's era as governor on up. We had a Justice for Janitors demonstration there in the early 1990s, and multiple people wound up with broken bones. This was a group of people just trying to organize, the people who cleaned the buildings, just trying to organize for fair wages. And the police responded to this small group of janitors by beating them up as they walked across an open area in Century City. And ironically, the person in charge of that is the person who rose to be the deputy chief and who is probably now the biggest advocate of a different style of policing at protests. But it's a long effort to educate them all.
Carol, it's always a pleasure, and good luck in your next cases.
And really, congratulations
on
this tremendous victory out in Los Angeles.
We have a way to go until it's final approval, but we are hopeful. Okay,
thanks.
Okay,
Carol.
Okay, thanks for talking
Bye-bye.
To us. Heidi, you know, there's a backstory to this. Our colleague, Jim Lafferty, who's the executive director of the Lawyers Guild out in Los Angeles, had developed a relationship with a number two man in the police department. And he had since gone on. I think he's the head of the Orange County Police Department now. And after this settlement was announced, he called Jim up and he said, "Thank you, Jim. You did good work. I support this settlement. You've educated me as to what it means to be for civil liberties. I congratulate the Lawyers Guild for what they did here. The number two guy in the LAPD, quite something.
I wish that were happening in every big city around the country."
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. We're pleased to have with us Nora Eisenberg, the author of the recent book, When You Come Home. It's a powerful novel that acknowledges the physical and psychological effects of veterans returning from Desert Storm. In this beautifully written anti-war fiction, Nora delves into the corrosive effects post-war combat has on the families and communities, as they often are called on to nurture veterans returning home.
Nora, we're really glad you're here, and welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here.
Nora, your book is quite moving, exciting, well-written. You're one of our favorite novelists. This one was interesting, I think, to all of us because it's a novel about what is referred to, at least by many, as the good war. I'm trying to figure out why you would write a book about the good war. Why not the bad war?
Well, I agree. The take on the present war in Iraq and Afghanistan is that that's the bad one. Well, I don't know about Afghanistan.
Now, Afghanistan, some people call a good war also.
Right. And you'll notice that even the most progressive politicians will never question the 1991 war. That's the good war with the good coalition. You know, we really had the world behind us. It was just the precursor of this war. There was really nothing good about it, despite the nostalgia and respect that it's viewed with today. You'll remember, I mean, before the war, it was very unpopular, very early in 91.
In fact, my office opposed it. We brought a lawsuit. The Senate had not actually gotten 51 votes to authorize it.
Right.
And it was only after our lawsuit and after we essentially won it, where a judge said, you need the votes. I mean, more or less he said
right.
that the Senate
right.
then got, I think, 51 or 52 votes. It was close.
Right. Well, it really was a public relations feat, and it remains that, in fact. I don't know, have you read John MacArthur's book, The Second Front? It's about censorship in the first Gulf War.
Rick MacArthur. Yeah, we call him Rick. It is John, right.
It is John. He points to all of the censorship that nothing got through during that five-week war, and nothing is still getting through. It was run really on the basis of, we don't say lies anymore, falsehoods, fabricated by a Washington PR firm called Hill & Knowlton, whose Washington office was run by a man named Craig Fuller. And Craig Fuller was the chief of staff for Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush and remained a very, very close family friend. So he was really in charge of mounting the campaign to impress the public with what villains the Iraqis were. And so they brought this young girl to testify before Congressional Committee, and she, do you remember, she said that she had been volunteering in a maternity ward.
I know this case well.
In Kuwait, the mean Iraqi soldiers came in and they hurled over 300 babies from their incubators, and they were left to die on the floor. She actually was part of the Kuwaiti royal family. Her father was the Kuwaiti ambassador to Washington, and the Kuwaitis had a $10 million PR contract with Hill & Knowlton. She never volunteered in any ward. It was a completely fabricated public relations incident.
I want to take you from the good war and understanding what happened to the theme of this novel, which is, of course, it follows at least three characters, a mother, a stepdaughter, and a man named Tony who went and fought in this so-called good war. But it follows them through their lives, and even in his case, his father was killed in Vietnam, actually, so it goes back into more bad wars. But it also takes an issue that a lot of us, you know, heard a lot about, and I think probably most of our listeners barely know what's happened recently or how the book is, which is the Gulf War syndrome,
right.
Which is a theme that runs through these characters and how they relate to war.
Right, right. I started writing this book with the new bad war looming, and my sense was that 91 war wasn't over at all. Aside from what had been happening in the skies over no-fly zones and stuff like that, the deaths were so massive and so continuing among the Iraqis, for sure. This war was looming. My sense was that the old war was still going on. I was very aware of the Iraqi devastations. You know, I'd been following the dismantling of the health system, the deaths in the decade between the 91 war and the buildup of the 2003 war, amazing rise in disease, and particularly among children, and deaths that have been estimated between 1 and 3 million, basically dismantling one of the best, probably the best medical system in the Middle East, aside from Israel. That war was looming, and I thought to myself, is this going to happen again? We lost 148 soldiers, the U.S., in the 91 war. Are we going to again kill millions and get off scot-free? Does it really work that way in a war? Did it ever work that way? Then I started thinking about really the stories that were just vaguely in my mind about the suffering of our troops when they returned from the 91 war. But even among progressive people, there was very little, and there remains very little awareness of what this disease is.
What exactly is the Gulf War syndrome or illness?
It's a multi-system disease that attacks pretty much, you know, the respiratory system, the GI system, nerve system. It is a neurotoxic event initially. These soldiers were sick immediately. Some said they got sick as soon as they swallowed an anti-nerve gas pill that was given to many of them. That has a very interesting history in terms of conflict of interests and directors of boards. We can get to that soon. But they felt sick immediately when they were around the insecticides that were just soaking the tents and the whole area. They felt sick immediately. This was completely discounted, but really they had everything wrong with them. Their skin was screwed up. Their breathing was screwed up. They had terrible stomach cramps. They couldn't walk straight. They had vertigo. Really anything you could think of a person having wrong, including Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and ultimately cancers, many of them, particularly brain cancers. They had their loved ones, not just their wives, but people just who were near them. There's talk of their pets coming down with this. And then there's birth defects among children at a much higher rate. And that's been well documented. All of this was unknown to me when I started writing or thinking about the project. It really remains unknown. I spoke to a lot of progressive doctors who were involved in occupational medicine. They did not know about this in any substantial way. And when I said, what about the story that the families get it, they tapped their heads to say it was all in the head.
One of the first examples where an individual who had returned got body rash all over and went to the doctor and was just given serotonin uptake re-inhibitor, Prozac or something.
Right.
How long did that continue that doctors treated that way, calling it just stress-related, psychological?
Pretty much till now. There is no treatment for it because there's been no serious acceptance of what is most evident and has been for almost two decades. On a scientific level, I don't only mean in the physical appearance of disease, but in research. This was known from substantial reports on the part of troops and veterans as early as 91. As early as 98, there was really some very, very basic research that had been done that showed where in the brain these chemicals attacked. That was only attended to by a small number of people. Now, so it's taken till now, and I mean just this past November, for a congressionally mandated committee to say what the veterans have known for almost 20 years, that they were poisoned.
And it's a huge number. It's like a third, I think, in the releases I read with the book.
Some say it's just under a third. Some say it's over a third, some of the veterans groups. The new report, which has, huge high power scientists, huge reputations, like the dean of science at BU, Roberta White, they said this is without a doubt caused by neurotoxins that soldiers were exposed to in the 91 war. And interestingly, these were not neurotoxins from Saddam Hussein. These were neurotoxins from different sources of our own toxic enterprises.
So we were poisoning our own troops.
In several ways. The anti-nerve gas pill, which was given to 250,000 of the troops. It's called pyridostigmine bromide, PB for short. It was given, by the way, for you lawyers, with no informed consent, because the DOD quickly, they got some regulation lifted that there had to be no informed consent. And when soldiers objected, they were threatened with court-martial. There's a lot of incidents of that.
We don't give that anymore, though, do we?
Actually, yes. It was an experimental drug because the doses were so high. It had been used for myasthenia gravis at a much, much lower rate level. But anyway, this PB was given to many of them with no protocol at all. Some divisions decided to give them, 10 in 3 days. Some gave them 2 a day for 10 days. Also, the insecticides and pesticides were wildly, it was all over their bodies and all over everything they had, which then they brought home. So there they had this toxic material.
In their body.
On their stuff. Right. These are the culprits. I mean, there was a big band of culprits, and it's not all clear. They have not ruled out this new report that came out at the end of November, has not ruled out other terrible exposures. They also point to the sarin poisoning. There was an event during towards the end of the 5-week war when we were on the ground destroying a big munitions plant. We knew it was a munitions plant and storage facility. There's a lot of evidence that U.S. corporations sold Iraq these terrible toxic chemicals like sarin and soman. So we had every reason to believe that a munitions factory would have some very bad stuff in it, but we bombed it. The sarin spread for hundreds of miles, and the DOD and the VA denied this.
I want to remind our listeners, we're talking with Nora Eisenberg, well-known novelist and author of a terrific book, When You Come Home. And it's a story about a returning soldier and soldiers from the so-called Good War, the First Iraq War. Quite a moving book, quite compelling. Give us a little description of some of the characters in there and who they are. I want to get people interested in getting into this book because it does a lot with war. It does a lot with the way the U.S. was really intentionally negligent or more than that toward our own soldiers, but of course toward Iraqis as well.
It starts, and these are really the three protagonists, a mother who's a midwife. Her name is Mimi. And she was a war widow. Her husband signed up for the Vietnam War, really just in a kind of reactive way because she broke his heart, So he dies, her husband dies, and she raises her child by herself, and she ends up raising the neighbor's child. And that family also has a Vietnam legacy. The father became a junkie and abusive. The mother ran off thinking that was the best way to protect the child. That girl, Lily, becomes an important character, and they're kind of like a Heathcliff and Kathy. They've been raised together, then, realize that it's beyond kid, quasi-sibling connection to a bona fide physical adult love, near adult. They're kind of still young kids, and that's another point I want to make, how young these kids are. They come home, and it's going to be a happily ever after. The Vietnam War really looms in the book because it was the last big war before the 91 war, and it was also cast as, it was like a rematch. We lost in Vietnam. This is what was, largely engineered by Bush's father. He said, we're going to kick Vietnam syndrome once and for all. This was going to restore American
bloodthirstiness.
But we weren't going to look like a bunch of losers. Right. And Americans watched this on television like a video game. There was a blackout of real death. That's when they stopped showing bodies at Dover. You didn't see the civilian casualties. You didn't see the highway of death, for example, which features in the book, which was a catastrophic massacre.
That's the retreat of the Iraqi soldiers,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
When we just bombed them continually while they were retreating, as I
right.
recall.
There was a ceasefire, not brokered by the U.S., brokered by the U.N. and the Soviets, who were about going to be around for another few months. There were actually two highways of death, one Schwarzkopf led and one that Barry McCaffrey did. And that was one that Seymour Hersh revealed. It was smaller scale and less known. But it, basically in both of them, they incinerated whoever was retreating on the road back to Baghdad.
I understand there were 100,000 Iraqi soldiers killed at one time.
Yeah, the estimates vary, but they're definitely in the many tens of thousands. There were also a lot of Palestinian civilians who were leaving Kuwait because a lot of Palestinians lived in Kuwait as near slaves and despised the wealthy ruling Kuwaiti regime and actually was soft on Saddam Hussein because he had championed the Palestinian cause. So they, whatever they thought personally, they were seen as the enemy also by these campaigners from the sky. They were basically hit with depleted uranium, napalm, everything. It was they called it a turkey shoot, and there was that terrible mix. It ended up traumatizing a lot of the people who had been there, a lot of the Americans who had been there, but it also invigorated a lot of them at the moment. And they played Metallica, William Tell Overture, as they swooped down in these A-10s and basically melted.
Wow.
There was one picture of it that was in the U.S. press, and it lasted under 24 hours, I think. It was pulled. But the rest of the world, the European population, citizens, and the press has been much, much more responsible on that. It's supposed to be happy ever after because Vietnam has been fixed. You know, the shame and sense of loss and weakness has been fixed. America's strong again. We only lost 148 soldiers, a third from friendly fire. They lost tens of thousands of soldiers and 100,000 civilians straight away. It was a feel-good war that people walked away from, you know, and we were happily ever. So that the kids in the book think that war is behind them. Everybody came home safe and sound, and now we can really live happily ever after. So it's sort of it's an American fantasy. Fortunately or unfortunately, it breaks down very quickly because friends start getting sick with what we come to know is a Gulf War illness or syndrome.
So it's also an American tragedy.
Yeah, it is an American tragedy. I said it in Virginia because that was is the site of so much war and so many military organizations from the Pentagon down to all the stuff in Norfolk. And for America, it was a really blood-stained state. It is a blood-stained state.
Nora, I'm curious now, in your research, what is the long-term effect? Are there a lot of fatalities of individuals who were subjected to these chemicals?
Yeah, there are, again, various estimates. 10,000, 15,000 are said to have died. Over 200,000 or just the Veterans for Common Sense, which is a group I really think a lot of, and they do a lot of litigation and a lot of dissemination of information. They think it's higher. They're very, very sick. Until now, the government has not owned up to this. There's been slow movement, but there's also been a lot of corruption and coincidence of events, I guess conspiracy. One thing that came out in this report of the Research Advisory Committee was that the Veterans Administration directed the Institute of Medicine, which is an independent body that is charged with developing the reports for different government agencies. So they were asked by the VA to publish all the research that was coming out on Gulf War syndrome or illness. Now it's illness. The directions they gave them limited the extent to which they could claim causation. This is really interesting. And this report said you have to redo your directions to the Institute of Medicine. They wrote 9 reports, hundreds of pages long. Redo them and change your directives because what we have is skewed and unscientific findings. I mean, this is astonishing. That was not that reported, you know, in what came out 2 months ago. So that all has to be revisited. Basically, the way in which it became so skewed is they did not allow the Institute of Medicine to include studies that used animals. There is so much to talk about this war. And, of course, the soldiers are coming home again, once again, very, very sick. Not from what we think of as the usual
post-traumatic stress.
They're calling a lot post-traumatic stress that is probably toxic. And also mild traumatic brain injury. So, we have almost 400,000 soldiers coming back who are patients. And about 40% of that, I think, are psychiatric patients. It doesn't add up unless you start considering the TBI, the traumatic brain injury, and the toxic exposure, which has been getting some press recently.
Nora, we want to thank you, and we also want to recommend When You Come Home. It's a wonderful book. I think all three of us have read it. And if you really want an introduction, which is what I think, unfortunately, people need because the toxic report came out in the middle of the election, a lot of people missed it. An introduction to the beginning of a series of bad wars, you can start this book, and you'll understand it, and you'll understand the Gulf War syndrome probably almost better than anyone else. Well, so thank you very much, Nora.
When You Come Home by Nora Eisenberg. It's published by Curbstone Press, which in and of itself is an interesting story because they publish books for the movement. We want to support Curbstone. We want to support Nora Eisenberg. Read When You Come Home.
It's a very intimate read.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.